The reading this evening is from Isaiah chapter 52, verses 13 to chapter 53, verse 12, and can be found on page 741 of the Church Bibles. So Isaiah chapter 52, verse 13. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond human likeness, so he will sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. Yet who of his generation protested? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. This is the word of the Lord.
Lynn, thank you very much indeed. It would definitely help, I think, to keep your Bibles open at Isaiah 52 and 53, because we're going to try and look at that in a little bit of detail tonight. For those of you who are maybe new tonight, or you're just haven't been for a little while, we are in a series which we're calling Emmaus Rewind. And what we're doing is we're looking at a 7-mile walk that Jesus took along with two other disciples just after Easter, although they didn't know it was Jesus. And during that walk, we know that one of them was called Cleopas, we don't know the name of the other one. During that walk, Jesus, in a sense, explains from the Old Testament scriptures why it was that the Messiah had to suffer and to die. Because these poor disciples are just walking away from Jerusalem, absolutely distraught by what's happened, convinced it's all over. And we're looking at some of the Old Testament texts that we would think Jesus would have included in that wonderful wonderful tour of the Old Testament, which brings us to Isaiah 53 tonight. So that's where we're heading. Now, we absolutely know that Jesus was mulling over this very passage in Isaiah 53 just a couple of days before that walk to Emmaus. At the Last Supper, as Jesus and his friends prepare to go and pray in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus quotes Isaiah 53 to his disciples. And he says, this is in Luke 22, he says, "Now, if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. If you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, 'And he was numbered with the transgressors,'" which comes right at the end of Isaiah 53. It's a doom-laden, frightening thing for Jesus to say, saying the night is closing in, evil is on the prowl, things are going to get worse. And in case we're in any doubt that Jesus talked to Cleopas and his friend about Isaiah 53, this passage is quoted a further 10 times in the rest of the New Testament. So we can see that it very quickly became a really important part of sort of Christian understanding of how the suffering and the resurrection of Jesus was foreshadowed and foreseen in the Old Testament. Now, I don't know how much you know about the book of Isaiah. It's a book that was written around about 750 years before Jesus' birth. It's a book warning Israel of judgment and then bringing the promise of restoration. And the middle section of Isaiah is quite a long book, 66 chapters, I think it has. But the middle section is filled with the hope of Israel's future liberation from their captivity in Babylon. And it contains four prophetic songs. And each of those prophetic songs looks into the future and talks about the time when a servant of God will come and talks about the role that this servant will have in restoring Israel. And the emphasis in these songs is that this servant is going to be chosen by God and anointed with the Spirit. They're going to bring justice as well as bringing peace, and that they will be a light to all of the nations. And the fourth of those four songs is the passage which we had read for us tonight from the end of Isaiah 52 and all of Isaiah 53. It is a truly subversive passage because the character and the mission of the servant of God is colored in here in this passage more fully than it's been before. But it takes a really surprising twist, because what this song says is that the servant will suffer and the servant will be despised and it will look like the servant has failed, and actually it looks like they will be wiped out altogether. And as we're reading and hearing these words, we're thinking, well, how that doesn't sound very servant of God. You know, where's God's blessing? Where's God's protection? Where's God's hand on this person's life if all of these terrible things happen? Let's first of all imagine how Jesus might have talked about this passage with his friends on the road. I wonder what he would have been drawing their attention to. And I can see at least four themes that are sort of interweaved through this that Jesus might have drawn out. The first is that the servant prophesied in Isaiah 53 is a very unlikely, we might say a very surprising servant of God. But then we'd have to qualify that and say, well, unlikely, yes, until we get to understand the ways of God better. And then we know that actually this is classic God. There are no markers, Isaiah says, there are no markers of greatness in the servant. There's no stunning looks. There's no regal physical presence. There's no impressive pedigree. You could walk past the servant in the street and you wouldn't for one second stop and look at them and think, wow, That's an interesting person. But it's more than the fact that the servant is ordinary and unremarkable. It's also that they will suffer so deeply. They will be abused and despised. The servant suffers to an extraordinary degree, the degree to which onlookers think, great kings and great prophets and great people of God should be protected from humiliation and from catastrophe. So this person, this so-called servant of God, cannot be a servant of God. They can't be the real thing. The second feature we see in this song is that the servant is crushed and despised. They are a truly pathetic character. At the best, they're an object of pity. Not only do they suffer greatly, but the watching crowd conclude that their suffering is so great and so miserable that it must be a punishment from God, that they must have done horrible, evil, terrible things to have suffered so much. And so the servant doesn't only suffer, but they are despised by other people as a failure, as a letdown, as a disappointment, as an embarrassment. And to make it even worse, they seem to be annoyingly passive. The phrase that is used in Isaiah is like a lamb to the slaughter. And so the watching crowd are thinking, why doesn't the servant at least stand up and fight for their corner and fight for what is right instead of just lying down and taking all of this punishment? The third feature, though, is that the servant will be innocent but will be suffering for others. The people watching this servant will have two light bulb revelations. The first is that they will realize at some stage that he didn't deserve or merit any of this suffering. That actually, he was entirely innocent. Secondly, though, that he was suffering on behalf of other people. There was purpose, there was intent, there was forethought. There were vast reserves of compassion spent on his part for other people. It was, to use the old English word, vicarious. The servant was suffering nobly and patiently for the good of others. And this is made all the more amazing because at the time of his suffering, no one could see this. No one could understand what was going on. It just looked like a terrible failure, an abandonment by God, a punishment from God. But there is a fourth and final strand in Isaiah 53. The servant of God will be, at some point in the future, will be vindicated. There will be recognition. He will be lifted back up. The suffering that so defines the servant won't be the end. It won't be the final word in his story. The suffering, there will be vindication. There will be recovery. There will be recognition of what was actually happening. And the overflow of this seemingly pathetic and tragic death will actually be world-changing and life-changing. Now, if that's how Jesus might have spoken about the highlights of our passage in Isaiah 53, he might also have spent some time drawing the attention of Cleopas and his friend to some of the more specific ways that Isaiah 53 was fulfilled in detail in the events of that past tumultuous week in Jerusalem. Remember, this is kind of Sunday afternoon. And it was only Friday that Jesus was killed, and it was only the start of that week that all of that tremendous run-up to Jesus' death had happened. So it's all really fresh in their minds. But look with me, look at chapter 52, verse 11. His appearance was so disfigured, his form marred beyond understanding. You know, think of the punches, think of the whipping that Jesus endured. Think of the crown of thorns that was pressed into his head. Think of the punishment that was rained down on him by the soldiers. That definitely would have left him looking unrecognizable in his suffering. Look at 53, 2 and 3. He was like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty. Now think back to Jesus' risk-filled birth in a backwater, chased into Egypt by Herod's soldiers. Think about there's never any mention in the New Testament that Jesus had great good looks or amazing physical presence, or that people somehow, because of his appearance, stopped in wonder. It wasn't his physical appearance, it was his character. It was his compassion. It was his love that was so remarkable. Look at verse 4 and 5 of chapter 53. The prophecy that Jesus' death would be for our sins and for the things that we've done wrong. Think about Jesus' words recorded in Mark 10, 45. He says there, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Think of Jesus' cry of dereliction on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Think of the curtain in the temple torn in two at the very moment of Jesus' death, at that symbol of all that separates us as people from a holy God suddenly no longer existing. Something more profound was happening. Look at verse 7 of chapter 53, that he was led like the servant was led like a lamb to the slaughter. We know already from this series that Jesus most definitely talked about the Passover lamb from Exodus to Cleopas and his friend, the innocent lamb whose blood saved the people from judgment. And we know too that Jesus was silent before his accusers, much to their fury. Look at verse 8, that God's servant would be cruelly mistreated and no one would complain. We know that the majority of Jesus' friends did desert him at his death, that the consensus in Jerusalem just a few days before was that Jesus was rightly and justly condemned, that people were shouting for his death. No one was complaining that this was a miscarriage of justice. Look at verse 9. The servant will be assigned a grave with the rich. Jesus' family was poor. They didn't have a grave in Jerusalem. And so we know that Jesus was buried in the grave of a quietly loyal admirer called Joseph of Arimathea. Look also at verse 12. And you will see there that it says, He bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Do you remember what happened when Jesus was on the cross? Luke tells us that he said to his father, "Father, forgive them," about the soldiers who were banging the nails through his wrists and through his feet. So what might have been the overall impact on the disciples from Jesus reminding them about Isaiah 53 as they walked from Jerusalem down to Emmaus? Surely it's this. Surely it was that God's purpose was always to bring restoration and hope through his suffering servant. It was always the plan. There it is in Isaiah 53. The servant would take on many things that weren't his for us. Now, I think this could have had great force for Cleopas and his friend on that day. I can imagine Jesus saying to them, "You know, I understand that you're shocked by what was done to Jesus. You loved him. You knew him well. You can't believe that this wonderful man that you so respected became the object of so many people's derision and so much hatred. You can't comprehend or get your mind around all that violence that was rained down on him, the humiliation that he suffered, the abandonment by friends and seemingly by God. Jesus might have said, you see these today as tragic, unexplained reverses of fortune, as tragic mistakes. But that's not right. It's deeper than that. Isaiah had seen it 750 years ago, that this was exactly how God's servant would bring restoration and hope, that as the innocent one, he would take on the sin and the greed and the violence of us all as like a sacrificial Passover lamb, that it wouldn't make sense to the people watching. It would look and smell like failure, like catastrophe and dishonor. But it wouldn't be the end of the servant. Vindication and life and God's goodwill would return for the one who poured out his life. It's fascinating to me that of all the verses from Isaiah 53, it's chapter 53, verse 12, that Jesus chooses to quote on the night of his arrest, that the servant of God was numbered with the transgressors, or was in a sense counted as being part of the group of sinful people. It says a lot. It reminds us that Jesus was never aloof. He was never otherworldly. He was never a religious snob. He came down to the dust and the dirt to save our lives. It reminds us that Jesus was known and criticized for his deep, open, curious friendships with every kind of person, always calling the broken to get fixed rather than to get stuffed. It reminds us that Jesus was killed alongside two criminals, the most ignoble of deaths, facing the indifferent fury of the Roman Empire. It's not the kind of noble death that you would expect for the son of a king, because he was numbered among the transgressors. It reminds us that Jesus cried out in the agony of dereliction and abandonment on the cross, that he willingly and lovingly stood in our place of punishment, taking on our sin, our greed, sin so great that Jesus could no longer even see or sense his Father. It reminds us that Jesus gave himself up. Jesus gave himself away for love. Now, of course, this is always what love has done. And this is always what love does. It is the very definition of love, that it is self-sacrificing, that we put ourselves out for the good, for the sake of those that we love. That's how we measure and know what love is. It reminds us that Jesus was treated by God as if he'd done everything that we'd done. So at that moment on the cross, Jesus is counted among the transgressors. He's now one of us, one of humanity. And God treats him in that moment as if he'd done everything that we'd done, all of that stuff that all of us have done. But for this purpose, that when we believe, God treats us as if we've only done what Jesus did. He treats us as clean and pure and redeemed. It's radical. Other religions boast of the strength and the power available to us from their strong, mighty God. Jesus says salvation is for the weak, and it comes from the despised. Jesus says being rescued, being saved, is for the weak, but it comes from the cursed, and it comes from the forgotten. Salvation comes from a weak, dying Jesus. And it's only the weak who see it and smell it and savor it and run to it. Whereas the strong and the comfortable and the wise in their own eyes, they just look on perplexed. Doesn't make any sense. Isaiah saw this 750 years before the death of Jesus on the cross. Cleopas and his friend were the first to see it just 3 days after the cross. But it's still crystal clear to any of us who bother to look. Jesus was the suffering servant of Isaiah 53. Jesus was the man of sorrows, the despised one that Isaiah had foreseen and sung and talked about all those years before. This was God's plan all along, embraced by Jesus as the cost of real love. Jesus' death then was no accident. It was no tragic mistake. It was a daring, sacrificial, costly, but easily overlooked act of redemption and restoration. And Jesus chose it. And the reason Jesus chose it was in love for us. Amen.